ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you think you'd never be targeted with disinformation? Well, remember hearing about those new Australian road rules? Curfews for drivers over 60 and mandates to keep your lights on. That was actually an AI disinformation campaign. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist, and I've been learning that online tactics just like this are being used regularly to seed mistrust in government decision-making. You can join me as I interrogate the world of mis and disinformation. Stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
This is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols, and today I've got a book for you that is sexy and surprising, and an author I think you are going to love. The Safe Keep by Yael Van der Wouden is one of my favourite novels of recent years. And I'm not alone in my love for this book. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize and it went on to win the Women's Prize for Fiction. The Safe Keep is set in the Netherlands 15 years after the end of World War II. It's about an uptight woman, an unpredictable house guest, loneliness, repression, and desire. I met Yael Van der Wouden on Gadigal land at last year's Sydney Writers Festival. It was the end of a three-week tour of Australia and New Zealand for Yael, who was still adjusting to life on the road.
Listen, I think this morning Philip Sand asked me, like, oh, have you met? And then he said somebody famous. And I was like, you have to understand. Not only was I, like, this is my first everything.
Right.
I was a teacher before. Like, I was a teacher 5 seconds ago. I was, not only do I not know anyone, I've never been this far away from home. I've never sort of been on the side of, it's just everything is really, I feel very wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and excited to be here.
That we're really excited to have you. And this, is, I guess, is your first taste of this touring life.
Yes,
which is going to go on for a while, because if you've been on the Booker shortlist, it keeps you going for a while. So tell me the best thing about being on tour and the worst thing about being on tour.
Oh God, that's going to be such a boring answer, I believe. The worst thing is it's being away from family and being away from my girlfriend, who... We thought 3 weeks was not that, but it's quite long. The suitcase, you know, at the beginning I was trying to be really neat about everything and now everything's chaos. At some point I started to forget, because the hotel rooms are, you know, they're all hotel rooms, and then you start sort of getting off on the wrong floor and walking down the wrong, and then you're just trying to open the wrong door. It's like, why won't it open? But the most wonderful thing is, of course, friends I met along the way. I'm so sorry, it's true. But I really, like, for example, in New Zealand, I got to really sort of connect with some of the organizers there and the interviewers. And of course, the other, I call it summer camp. It feels like summer camp because you're always with the same authors in the same hotels. And so you kind of lean on each other a little bit and check in on each other. At least I check in on the others. I don't know if they want me to do it. But I've gotten into the habit of sending everyone texts. Hello, how are you doing? Have you had breakfast? We were talking about being the elder sister just now. I think it's that energy.
The organizer energy.
It's sort of like you want to make sure that everyone's okay and has eaten enough, yeah.
Yeah, Elle and I were bonding backstage that we're both big sisters and we've both got very strong big sister energy. Elle, you write both in Dutch and in English, which is just so impressive. Does one language come more easily to you than another?
You say I write in Dutch. I do it... I mean, if when they force me to do it, I do it. When they pay me to do it, I do it. And the best way I can explain it is the writing in Dutch, because I started speaking Dutch when I was 10, and that's just on the cusp. Either you're going to get the grammar or you're not. And I was on the not. It didn't quite work out with me and the grammar. Dutch has de het. Kind of like the German has der, die, das. It has, what do they call them? The pronouns that change depending on the gender of the word.
Right.
And if you speak it from childhood, that's something that you don't even have to wonder whether a word is done het. I never know, and so I...
Like if the chair is male or female.
Exactly, yeah, I just give it a wild guess, and mostly, you know, either it's wrong or it's right, right? But the best way I can explain writing in Dutch is as if somebody's taken off my hands and put them on the wrong wrist, and so I can pick up everything. I can still do it, but the thumb is on the wrong side. Mm. And so it's a little bit uncomfortable. And I have to have rigorous editorial help with it. And so I do it, but I don't do it very often. So English, I grew up speaking English because my parents didn't speak each other's languages. They speak it quite impressively well, but like not fluently enough when I was a kid. And so they've always spoken English to one another.
So what were the languages that your parents were speaking?
My mom speaks Hebrew and my dad speaks Dutch.
That's amazing. How do you fall in love with somebody who speaks another language?
Well, they have to be really sexy, I imagine. My mom was in the Netherlands for art school, and they both met in art school. I think they had to do a film together. They were both in film and animation. And they had to do a film together. And I think, I don't know if they allow me to tell this story, but it's not very, you know, I think it's quite tame. My mom threw a party, for as far as I remember. My dad came over and then never moved out. Is how, yeah.
That's so lovely. And I think probably doing a creative project together, the sparks would fly there. That's really gorgeous. Knowing Hebrew, knowing Dutch, knowing English, can you talk a bit about what the English language can offer you when it comes to writing fiction?
I think my English, it's funny, because I had a conversation with a German reader who said, I can see in your English that it's not your complete language. Because my language, I wouldn't say that my first language is fully English. I would say that it's a tapestry, right? It's a little bit of everything. And anybody who's multilingual can tell you, you use the one language to talk about food and the one language to talk about sort of the actions, we're gonna go here, and then the third language to talk about taxes. that's Dutch for me. And so my language, the language that I'm proficient at is a language that only my parents speak. And my sisters. It's that sort of that chaos of three languages. And so when I write in English, which, you know, that's the only thing I do, I'm always going to have, and I do this in Dutch as well, I always have to maneuver the places where the other language wants to interrupt, where the Dutch wants to come in, or a phrase in Hebrew wants to come in, or even the cadence, because every language has a different rhythm. I either have to negotiate with it or allow it in or say like not right now, this is, you know, this sentence needs to be proper. And so it's not something that is very conscious, but so this German reader said to me, I could see sometimes that you had a moment in the book where you could have picked a word that, let's say, a native English speaker would have chosen, and you went for a different word because probably that's what, you know, as a multilingual speaker, that's what your brain then provided for you. I had a whole conversation with one of my editors about meat versus flesh, primarily in the sex scenes.
And you go for flesh, right?
I do go for flesh, yeah. And she was like, I'm pretty sure that that's a Germanic sort of thing, flesh, you know, and meat has a different etymological origin, and whether, like, what feels more natural and what feels, let's say, sexier, and what feels like, oh, you're describing pork or something. You
know? I'm now thinking about the added complication of writing in English about people who are speaking Dutch.
Oh, that was fun to me, because that's like, oh, that's natural to me. That's how my brain works. It's English with like an undercurrent of Dutch. But it was fun to sort of figure out. There was a moment where, at one point, one of the characters says "pardon," which is pardon, and then my English friend said, she read it and she said, oh, this is like a hypercorrection because posh English people never say pardon. Like that's a middle class thing that it tries to imitate sort of this idea of wealth. And I said, no, that's not what I'm doing. This is Dutch. It's pardon. It's not pardon. And so there's like these moments where also turns of phrases. There's like a few in the diary. I don't know. How many of you have read it already? Okay.
Oh
wow.
My gosh, like about, what, 75%
right.
of the audience?
Very, very good, A+. there's, in the diary, there's a diary for those who haven't read, there's a diary section at one point, Ava says in the diary section, April does what it wants. And my non-Dutch readers, my first readers said, haha, this is such a random thing, and the Dutch knew immediately because that's just a saying. It's a Dutch saying, April doet wat hij wil. And so it was funny to see that the people who didn't know it thought it was me, just something, my personality, and then the Dutch readers knew immediately sort of what it referred to. So there's a lot of little sort of Easter eggs, as it were, if you speak other languages that you might recognize in the book.
That's absolutely fascinating. So you spent the first 10 years of your life in Israel, and then mm-hmm. you came across to the Netherlands where you started speaking Dutch. What was it that brought your family to the Netherlands?
Many things. I mean, it's difficult right now to speak of Israel, and I don't want to do it with a sense of... I want to be careful with how I speak of it, and I want to be careful of not coming across as nostalgic. I don't want to, you know, speak with nostalgia about a country and a government whose action I'm so deeply opposed to. But we came mostly for work reasons. My parents are artists, and I think that they saw that there would be more. The Dutch system at the time was far more supportive of, let's say, families who didn't quite make ends meet, and on top of that, there were my grandparents who lived in the Netherlands who could. Support us in just more ways than one, also just with, let's say, babysitting or we didn't have a car, my parents don't have a driver's license. My mom is currently studying for her driver's license in her 60s, very proud of her.
That's wonderful.
But my grandpa could drive us around, and so I think we lived in Tel Aviv, in Ramat Gan, for 10 years, and I think it was time for us to try the other version, and so we moved to Hoogeveen, where my grandparents lived. We lived there for 3 months with my grandparents, and then moved to Zwolle, where most of the book is set, nearby Zwolle. And it was, I would say, it was a culture shock for me. Mm. Yeah. No, I did not take to it very well. It took me many years to acclimatize to the weather, the people, the culture.
The language. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it was both very romantic as well, because we moved to a region of the Netherlands that was there was like a beautiful forest, and that's where my grandparents live, in the middle of the forest. And it was raining, and I'd never experienced anything like that, but also I'd never experienced anything like the social distance between people. Mm-hmm. And back in Ramat Gan, I would just leave the house. I had a key. I would just leave the house and I would find friends. I would just collect little stragglers along the street, and we would go to the park, and we would just spend an entire day at the park. And I would mostly, it was me scheming ways to get like a few cents to buy slushies. That was like our goal in life, buying slushies. And you know, it was either, oh, we're gonna do a daycare, or we're gonna create T-shirts and sell them. You know, those kinds of, you know, there's always that kid in your street who's always scheming to sort of somehow, some, you know, very young entrepreneurial spirit. That was me. And then I went into writing, the most lucrative of all businesses.
You ended up in writing, but as a kid, were you interested in books and reading?
No. Well, okay. So I ended up studying comparative literature. And in comparative literature, I did a full circle. I was like, you know, What isn't text? Everything is text. You know, you go to the grocery store, the fruit is at the front, the whatever's in the back. They're trying to tell you a story about what you need to eat. That's narrative, right? That's mm-hmm. a story. Mm-hmm. Movies are stories. So in that way, I was very well read. So as I said, my parents both met in film and animation. So they were both in film. And so especially animation was like, that was the lingua franca at home. The first form of art that I learned was, I think, animation. And my parents sort of taught me how to create like a little animated, you know, stick figure thing.
Yeah, the flipping the pages of the book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, like they said, you know, you have to think before how you want the little puppet to move, or if you want to make a more expanded animation, you have to come up with, you know, what you want it to do. You need to create a storyboard. And so my approach to how I saw animation and how I saw stories has been from a very young age. You need to decide beforehand what's going to happen. And then I was, as a child, I hated going to bed. I'm really painting a picture of myself. It's a very intense young kid. But I never wanted the day to end. I was always really sad that the day ended. And I was afraid of being abducted by aliens because it was the 90s. And I don't know if you remember the alien craze of the 90s.
X-Files.
X-Files, but just like
Day.
But also just like the way that there's minions everywhere now. That was like little alien figurines in the 90s. They featured very largely in my imagination. I was really scared of that. And so what I did to calm myself down is I would go into mind theater, which is I would put an imaginary cassette into the VCR, and I would start playing one of the movies that I'd memorized all the movies that we had at home, and I would just start playing it from beginning to end. And mostly it was 101 Dalmatians. And I just started playing it, and usually sort of around scene three, I would fall asleep, and then the next night I could pick it up right there and continue. And then I think eventually I graduated to my own stories. But for a long time, it was just me playing cassette tapes in my mind.
Do you ever still watch Mind Theatre at night?
Oh, every single night, yes, of course. How else do you fall asleep?
Without 101 Dalmatians.
Yeah.
Yael van der Wouden on mind theatre, her multilingual childhood, and the flexibility of language. She was speaking to me, Claire Nichols, at last year's Sydney Writers' Festival. And here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National, this is a repeat of one of my favourite conversations from 2025. Yael is the author of The Safe Keep, which won last year's Women's Prize for Fiction. It was also shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Let's find out how the novel was born.
I know that during COVID lockdowns, you did this online writing workshop, and there particular prompt on silence.
Yes.
What was the story that you started?
Yeah, this was, I think it was by Longleaf Review, which is a fantastic journal, if you want to check it out. They offered this workshop, on silence, indeed. And the assignment was write. We first read Hills Like White Elephants by Hemingway, which is a short, brilliant short story about a couple at a train station not talking about an abortion. But clearly the conversation is about abortion. And the assignment was write a short story where your characters are not mentioning something, not speaking about the thing that is obvious. And so I wrote a short story about three siblings who go out for dinner, and one of them brings a girlfriend, and everyone hates the girlfriend, but no one mentions it. And then I was quite happy with that story, and I tried to submit it to several journals, and it was, alas, a no-go, which, you know, is part of the game, especially when you're a nobody. Also, when you're a somebody, like, it's not a guarantee. Journals are really strict. And then I think 2 years later or a year later, when I started scheming the notion of the safe keep and the premise of it, I had this moment where I was like, oh, I think I have the characters. I think I have everyone who needs to go into this puppet house. I already have them ready, and they were all sort of, they all came into existence in this short story.
Isn't that fantastic? So never let go of the short
story. Yes, you never know what little scrap of an idea might come in handy later on.
And the book is about another silence too, of course. It's set 15 years after World War II. Yael, can you tell us a bit about what the narrative is in the Netherlands about the Dutch experience of the war and I guess what came after the war?
I mean, it's been changing gradually thanks to the relentless work of many scholars and thinkers. So I am far from saying that, you know, this is the first work to discuss it, but within literature, what has primarily been the narrative around post-war Netherlands is, well, you have several very famous works that are like De Avonden van Gerard Reve, The Evenings. And it's very much about the monotony and the melancholy of post-war Netherlands, but it's written only from the perspective of Dutch non-Jewish citizens who had to experience the war. And the narrative around sort of how the Dutch dealt with the war and the fallout of it is very much of, you know, we had the resistance. The resistance looms very large in the Dutch imagination, even though if you compare it, you know, not to be like that, but if you compare it to other sort of neighboring countries, the resistance was actually quite minor in the Netherlands. And also, if you look at deportations and the amount of protests that were actually enacted, the Netherlands was really like one of the least active countries trying to push back against deportation at the time. And it had one of the highest rates, I think, second only to Poland, of their deported Jewish community.
And so it was 75%.
75%, yeah, it was incredibly high. And very few people returned. And of the people who returned, many of them were only in the Netherlands for like a month or two. And then they realized, no one wants us here. They allowed us to be deported because they don't want us here. This wasn't a mistake. This wasn't an error. They genuinely don't want us here. And so a lot of them immigrated to Canada, to South Africa, to South America. And so the Netherlands lost I think 90% of its Jewish population thereabouts, not just because of deportation and the deaths, but also the people who came back and then realized they weren't wanted. And by what I mean is by not wanted is, for example, they would have to prove to the tax offices that they didn't earn anything in the camps. So that they didn't have to pay any taxes over, you know, what they'd earned in the camps. People who hadn't been able to pay their mortgage had their houses taken away from them. They haven't been able to pay the mortgage because they were in the camps. The most horrifying story, I mean, they're all horrifying stories, but the story that I haven't been able to let go of is there were a lot of German Jews who fled to the Netherlands in the 30s. Like Anne Frank's family. I think also the sort of the reclamation of Anne Frank by the Dutch is fascinating because Anne Frank is German. She grew up in the Netherlands, but her family is German. So a lot of families fled to the Netherlands and then ended up being deported. And what happened in one case, one of them returned to the Netherlands. But because now the war was over, their status as a Dutch citizen was reverted back to a German citizen, and they were immediately then seen as, not a traitor, but there's a word for it in Dutch, but let's say sort of a traitor because they were now officially German and no longer a refugee, and so they were put back into prisoner of war camps together with German Nazis. And so this is like the way that the bureaucracy was being used in order to enact just continuous violence onto, and yes, this is Jewish community, but this was also for the Roma and Sinti. This is also for the queer community within the Netherlands. And also for the resistance fighters. But the reason why I mentioned the resistance fighters last is because for many, many years, when the Netherlands has, a Remembrance Day, the 4th of May, and a Celebration Day, the 5th of May. And the first 20 years after the war, the 4th and the 5th of May was about resistance fighters. It wasn't about the survivors of the Shoah. It wasn't about anybody, sort of the deportation. It was just about the resistance fighters. And it took the lobbying of everyone else who was impacted by the war, relentless lobbying in order to get... And it only happened in the 60s that the Remembrance Day was opened up, the language was opened up to include all the people who died in concentration camps, which is bizarre, right? Now we think about Remembrance Day, like, of course it's, you know. Mm. And then of course, it's even stranger to have that. I don't know how much you've been following the way that in Europe they've tried to sort of be like, okay, Remembrance Day is only about the Holocaust and about nothing else, and nothing else is it. But it's the way that it's always been in flux. And I also am a great believer that we don't have like one squared meter as a platform to remember one thing. We are capable of remembering and memorializing many things at once. So that's a long speech for a single short question.
It's really appreciated. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to me, Claire Nichols, speaking to Yael van der Woude at last year's Sydney Writers Festival. Yael is the winner of the Women's Prize for Fiction for her stunning novel, The Safe Keep. Now, as you've heard, the book challenges the prevailing narrative about the Dutch experience of World War II. But there's a lot more to it than that. The novel introduces us to Isabel, a repressed and lonely woman, and to Ava, her opposite in every way, who comes to stay at the family home. For these two women, the line between disgust and desire is paper thin. The novel, Yael, is set in the Netherlands in 1961. We're in this lonely house with Isabel. She is one of the most tightly wound characters I've ever met in fiction. Can you introduce us? Can you introduce us to Isabel?
Isabel, yeah, she's very tightly wound. She's very repressed. And I love a repressed character, but what has frustrated me many, many times in fiction is that there's a repressed character and then you never find out what it is they repress. They're just repressed and they get a relief at the end or not, but you never sort of really dig into what repressed them. So I really wanted to write a character where I could take the repression, turn it up to 90, and then see if I could sort of crack her like the spine of a book, you know, just see what happens if we slowly pick at all the things, because she is paranoid right at the mm-hmm. beginning. And then
the maids are stealing from the house.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What happened if somebody was actually stealing from the house, right? What happened if somebody's actually out to get her and all of her paranoia is actually correct? And then Ian Forster has this beautiful way of talking about characters, which is he likes to create characters that are so certain of themselves, and then you throw something into their lives that muddles them, that confuses them, that changes their understanding of themselves. And that's, I mean... Ian Forster is one of my favorites, and I love that in his writing because he does create characters that seem to be so certain of who they are and what they want in life, and then find out that in fact there's a whole world that they hadn't been aware of within themselves and what they desire. So,
I love this one little detail in the book about Isabel, that she's dismissive of people who read novels, especially romantic novels.
She would. I was like, who would Isabel hate? Me.
Yeah. She's lost both her parents, and she'd lost both her parents by the time she was 21. How much is she shaped by the grief she has, particularly for her mother?
Oh, I think her entirety is shaped by grief and fear and... Especially, I think, for her, it's abandonment. She has these two brothers, Louis and Hendrik. Louis is the oldest, and he's a real ladies' man. And he shows up with a new girlfriend every single time that they meet up. Even to his own mother's funeral, he showed up with a girl who he just dated briefly. And so Isabel...
No, he can't remember her name.
He can't remember her name. Isabel can't remember her name, and yet she's in all the pictures from the funeral.
Which makes Isabel fume.
She hates this. And so she sees sort of his, the way that he lives his life and the way that he lives his life specifically away from home, because she's the only one who's remained in the family home. Her two brothers have left. She sees it as betrayal in the name of love and desire. He has chosen love and desire, fleeting, and right. She has this, in her eyes, he's the most unreliable person. And that's because of how quickly he desires something, and then, you know, he has a toy and then gets bored of the toy and then throws it away. And then you have Hendrik, on the other hand, who is much more loyal, but the way she sees it, not to her. Because he left the house, or rather, he was kicked out of the house when he was 16 by his mother, when his mother found out that he was having an affair with a piano teacher, as one does. And she wanted to, she was there the day that he ran away, and she has tried to get him to come live with her again. But he hasn't, and he has gone and found lovers and settled down. And she has seen that yet again as a betrayal of her, as an abandonment. He has chosen love and desire over her. And so she has these two brothers who have both gone on with their lives, they're both on love, they both have jobs, right? They both can just, they live their lives. And while she is at home, she doesn't have a job, she doesn't have any friends, she doesn't have hobbies, she doesn't have, God forbid, friends. And everything that they stand for is what she's not allowed to have herself. That is desire and that is love. And she associates those things with selfishness and abandonment. And so when love and desire come into her own life, she puts up a good fight.
And that's when it gets good. She's looking after the family home, as you've said. Is this house to her a refuge, or is it a prison? I think in the book it's, you know, a tether or a shelter. Mm-hmm. What is that house to her?
Oh, it's both, of course. It's the only thing that she knows how to keep in order. Life is chaotic, right? She has all these memories. She has like these fleeting flashes of traumatic memories from her childhood. The bombs, the people sort of in the immediate post-war period sort of knocking on their doors trying to get in, people asking for food, for coals. She sees people break down in the streets. And she's not allowed. She's not allowing herself to enter into any of these memories, right? Also, linguistically, every time she has any form of self-reflection, the sentence breaks off, and she's not allowed to finish that sentence. And that's also how she speaks, very halted. No one's ever sort of, you know, no one ever gets to get to the end of a sentence, because if you get to the end of a sentence, then there's knowledge, and then there's awareness. And so that's also her relationship to memories, right? She's never allowed to dig any deeper than that. And so the house itself is, you know, it's the shell, right? It is the soft shell that surrounds her, and it's the only thing that she can keep in order. She keeps it clean, she keeps it neat, she keeps everything exactly where it belongs. And as long as she can do that, then she doesn't have to sit with herself. She doesn't have to sit with any memory. And it's also this idea, like, she went there, her family moved there during the hunger winter, which is the last winter of the war, where a lot of young Dutch children were sent from the west of the country to the east of the country, because in the west of the country was blocked off by the German troops, and so no food can come in. And so a lot of, many kids, in order to circumvent starvation, were sent to either friends, family, or anyone in the east of the country where there was more movement allowed. And that's how Isabel and her siblings ended up in the east in this house. And so this house represents to her, like, that's where they've gone in search of safety. And so she must keep it intact, also because she's the last one standing. Her siblings are both gone, her mother has died, her father's passed away when she was very young. Even the dog, you know, poor thing, has died. And so she sees love as this fleeting thing. Everyone leaves, everyone goes, and she just has to keep it together and keep this house together. And so when somebody enters the house who does not belong there, that threatens not just, you know, the order of life and the way things are, but just the entire system that holds her sanity together is about to crumble.
All right, let's meet Eva. So she's Louis's new girlfriend. She comes to this dinner, yeah, where no one likes her. And quite soon we find out that Eva's coming to stay. Louis going away for work and Eva's going, oh, I should go stay with your sister. She's so lovely. What does Isabel make of Eva?
Not much.
Because, you know, we talk about her violently peroxided hair, badly made dress. You know, we're seeing her through Isabel's eyes here, right? And she seems repulsed by her.
Yes. I mean, she is. She's repulsed, but I think, my therapist would always ask me, whenever I would be upset about something, she would always ask me, sort of, what are you feeling? Is it disgust or is it fear? Because to her, those were one of the, sort of the two base emotions. And disgust is interesting because disgust is it's so closely related to desire. And oftentimes the things that disgust us at first anyone who's read Freud will be able to attest to this, right? The things that disgust us can also flip very quickly into the same investment. It's sort of, what do you call it? Sunk cost, right? Anyone? This idea of like you've invested in sunk cost. You've invested in something so intensely. It's the way that, you know, sometimes we can be huge fans of celebrities and then they do one bad thing, or not one bad thing, several bad things. They do a bad thing. And then we turn that obsession into as fiercely judging them or criticizing them because we've already invested that time and that space. Not to go into that too much, but like I think that's sort of what Isabel's experiencing in her when she considers Eva. She Eva represents everything that she is not just in her dress and in how carelessly she presents herself, but also in the way that through Isabel's eyes, Eva is there to be desired by men and to be appreciated by men. And Isabel has never been able to understand that. I think she tries, right? There's Johan, the neighbor, who...
Every time she sees Johan, I was amazed by how many different ways you write she wanted to throw up. She's nauseous every time she looks at him.
She is, but that's the thing. When you're nauseous around somebody, there is the chance that everybody's like, oh, but you like them because you're nervous. That means you like them. And you're like, well, I guess you know better. And that's, that's something that I've also experienced myself where I tried to explain to people, whenever that person touches me, it makes me really nauseous. And then a friend would be like, oh, that's probably because you're nervous, because you like them. No. Sometimes you just really don't want to be touched by someone.
Yeah. Did you know from the minute that Eva comes through the door that Isabel desires her?
Oh, of course. That was the premise. It was always going to be the premise.
So what's the joy in writing this queer love story?
Well, I think what I enjoy the most, aside from the fact that I'm just a queer woman and therefore, I'm just not... I'm not going to be super happy writing about desire that isn't quite my own. I mean, I think that as authors, you can find joy in just about everything, but especially for this one, I knew what I wanted to do. But the joy of it was, I think it's quite a classic novel in terms of format, in terms of also perhaps even the language. It follows a very familiar structure, a three-act structure. It follows in the tradition of the classic British novel, right? The 19th century, sort of like in how it's set up and then how it falls apart. And I always think about Howard's End, not to continuously mention Ian Forster, but Howard's End, I'm going to spoil the end of Howard's End, but somebody gets hit on the head with a German sword and then gets buried under a bunch of books. And it's so clearly Ian Forster being like, beware of the continent and beware of class. And, you know, he was criticizing it, this idea of like, you know, you cannot sort of reach above your class. He was not saying like, oh, you know, that's something you shouldn't do. But there is that moralistic thing of the 19th century novel. And I think I was trying to mimic that, but then sort of create the box that looks the same, the outside looked the same, but then I wanted to fill it up with things that were just for me and things that I were interested in, things that are very traditional for the novel, primarily gay sex.
You're listening to The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction writers. And this conversation with Yael Fundevouden was recorded at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Yael was shortlisted for the Booker Prize for her novel, The Safe Keep. And since we recorded this chat, she is now the winner of the Women's Prize for Fiction. It's just an incredible result for a debut novel. As you've been hearing, The Safe Keep involves a romance between Isabel, a highly repressed woman, and Ava, who's flighty and freewheeling. And we're going to delve deeper into this romance now. And of course, romance leads to sex. We are going to talk in detail about sex writing, and there are going to be a couple of F words here. So please consider this your language warning. I think what makes these scenes in the book so beautiful and so rewarding is everything that leads up to it, the slow unravelling of Isabel. There's this one scene, it's really popular with readers, it's where Isabel eats a pear that Ava has given her, and she eats it core and all. Let's ask Yael to read it for us.
So this is quite early on in the book. They've been in the house for just a hot second, I think a week or so. Ava has gone to the city to get some groceries, and she comes back with a pear. Two pears, in fact. There was another pear left in the middle of the table, propped like a statue. Ava said, "I got one for you too. Just the one. Not a bag of pears or several for the fruit basket. Just the two. One for her, one for Isabel." "I don't want it," Isabel wanted to say. She said, "Thank you." She took the pear, put it in her pocket. Ava looked amused. "You won't eat it?" "Later," Isabel said, and then with a few abortive movements fled upstairs. In her bedroom, Isabel, sitting on the edge of her bed, held the pear in the cup of her hands. If she'd eat it now, she'd have to go downstairs to throw away the pits, the core. If she ate it later, Ava might walk by, see her eat it. She did not want Ava to see her eat it. She could throw the whole thing away. She could open the window and throw it away. It was a water-heavy fruit, full ripe. The first bite spilled on Isabel's skirt. It wouldn't show. The fabric was brown, checkered. There was no way of eating it in silence. The sounds it made, the wet. Isabel ate through the whole thing, the flesh and stick and pits and core and all. She made sure nothing was left of it, as though it had never been given in the first place. Her arms were dripping, wet all around her mouth. She had to wash her face in the basin afterwards. The spot on her skirt, where the fruit had stained, remained throughout the day, a cloying brush to the back of her hand.
That was Yael Fundevouden reading from The Safe Keep. Yael, how did you feel after you wrote that scene?
Oh, I remember that one because I was about to leave. And so I wrote it in a bit of a rush, but I still had a moment like, oh God, what a freak. but I was entertained by it. That was like the first time I got to write her sort of slowly doing a weird thing. And then she continues to stuff things in her mouth, right? At one point it's a shirt that she stuffs into her mouth entirely, the corner of a blanket, and then, of course, Ava.
Okay, let's talk about sex. You make a lot of jokes about chapter 10, thanking your family for not reading it, at least not mentioning it if they have read it. It's very steamy, very beautiful. How fun is it to write?
It's fun, like, but I think for me, the most important thing is that it is... It only works as a continuation of everything that came before it. I think if I just sat down and wrote the sex chapters before I'd written anything else, they wouldn't work. It is that tension that you have to create in the first 100 pages. And in the Esther Perelian way, like the eros that you put in in what comes before it. And that is the erotic tension that I talk about is, it's, to me, that sort of making, sort of having a conversation with a reader where you make the reader aware that they are voyeur in a certain way. And that happens in the language, that happens in the scene. And what I mean by that is some books allow you to exist as a camera, right? You get to be a wide shot or a close-up. But you never have to think about the lens that you're considering the scene with. And what I like to do is occasionally sort of take away the camera and just make you be a person in the corner of the room thinking, oh, I really shouldn't be here. This is not, this is, I'm an interloper. And the way that you do that is by, through very gentle close-ups that aren't necessarily erotic inherently, right? Oh, there's an elbow. Oh, okay, is an elbow sexy? Probably not, maybe to some people. Oh, there you have an ear, you have that. And then, you know, you cut that with like a really harsh close-up of something that is very clearly erotic, be it a mouth, be it the word fuck, be it a memory of, you know, at one point Isabel remembers walking in on her brother having sex with one of his girlfriends, and how that memory for the rest of her life comes to be connected to what she did next, which is go into the garden and dig with the stick into the earth. And so whenever somebody says the word fuck, she thinks about upturned earth. And so you're being sort of swung around between something that is very haptic, something that is very sort of, you know, visceral to the touch, and then away into a memory, and then into something that doesn't feel erotic, and then back to the eroticism. And that movement, that sort of texture, that is what makes you feel like the allowance and then the disallowance, right? The allowance, you're allowed to see this, but you're not allowed to see this. Kind of like a curtain wafting in front of a scene. That's what makes you a voyeur as a reader. And so if you have that for 100 and some pages or 200 pages leading up to the sex, once you do it in the sex scene, and then you kind of like pull back the curtain altogether, that's where eroticism comes in like its full force.
It's fascinating to hear you talk about this, and I know you've taught workshops on sex writing, so you've thought a lot about what makes for a good sex scene and what makes for a bad sex scene. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us one thing that makes for a good sex scene and one thing that makes for a terrible sex
well,
scene?
Well, the first thing that I will say is that, take out your little notebooks, is that I don't think there is such, I mean, I know there is such a thing as a bad sex scene, but I think it's about intention. If you want to write a sex scene that is humorous, and that's what you're writing, that if you've achieved your goal, that's not a bad sex scene, that's just your intention. So you need to sort of consider before what you want to do. We had to do a few days ago, or a week ago, I've lost track of time, this was in Auckland. It was me and several other authors reading our sex scenes, and everyone else's was really funny. And then I was just sweating because I was the last one to go. And I was like, I knew that there was not going to be, there's just not going to be any laughs in mine. And so I had to sort of warn everybody beforehand, like, okay, you've had your laughs. Stop laughing because this is where it ends. And I had a moment of like, oh, you know, why did it have to be so earnest? Because it is quite an earnest book. But... I do think that in order to write a good sex scene, there's two things that I'm going to have to do, right? I think you have to commit to it fully. You have to let go of this idea of like, there's the easy way out is leaning into the comedic, into the comedy of, if you don't want it to be funny and you still lean into the comedy of it, then you've not succeeded. The easy way out is also sort of over-dramatizing the grossness of bodies. Right? We all have bodies, they're all over gross, in my gentle opinion. Especially with sex, you know, there's sounds and there's wetness and it's not quite charming. And if you lean completely into sort of how strange and upsetting it can be, then what you've done is, this is case-by-case thing, but I think what most often happens is that you take the reader out of the agreement that you've both entered into, which you're going to pretend, this is reality, right? You're going to, in the world of fiction, there's like the social contract happening where you don't want to be taken out of it. You don't want to hear the author saying, oh, actually, I'm quite embarrassed about sex, right? You don't want to have that little voice enter in. And so you have to lean into the earnestness of it. You have to do it quite seriously. And This is from teaching what I've noticed the most. I think that if you borrow from your own life, that's going to get in the way. Mm-hmm. If you write sex scenes the way that you yourself remember having sex, what's going to happen is that you're going to describe movements rather than emotion, rather than desire. You have to remember that the readers have not been there with you. They've not felt the, you know, if you're in love or if you desire somebody, if there's lust, they've not felt all those things along with you. So if you want to have the reader come along on this journey with you, you're going to have to start where they are. And that is something brand new and something that you can't borrow from your own experiences. I don't know if you all signed up for this part of the lecture, but you paid for it, so there you go.
It's absolutely fascinating. I want to talk briefly about the Booker Prize. You were shortlisted for the Booker, which is such an amazing achievement for a debut novel. And this year, I've had the incredible pleasure of hearing about the Booker ceremony from the perspective of Samantha Harvey. I've asked Charlotte Wood. I've asked Rachel Kushner. I feel like I'm getting to each table at the ceremony to see what it was like. What was the experience of that ceremony like for you?
I was... First of all, sweating throughout the whole thing. I was so incredibly nervous. And this was followed up after sort of several days of... we were just, you know, ping-ponged around from event to event to event to the Queen. And my body started doing strange things. I started having pains that I'd never had before. And it was so clearly just anxiety. I was just, I was terrified of winning, mostly because everyone kept on saying to me and my girlfriend, you're not going to see each other if she wins. That's going to be a year of your life. You're never going to see each other again. And my girlfriend kept on looking at me with like increasingly terrified eyes. I was like, I will not? Where will you go? And I was like, I don't know. and also like the terror of, you know, this is my first book. And as amazing as it would have been, there was that continuous terror of like, will I ever write anything again if I win this? And I think, I have this conversation with a good friend of mine who's also an author many times where it's just like, oh, it would have been, the best thing to do is to start off with a book that no one, I know this sounds so ungrateful, but this, you know, this is sort of like a flippant conversation that we have. A book that sort of like is a whisper in the wind and then slowly build up, because then you build up the psyche that is able to deal with everything that comes out at you. And this is, I kept on thinking there's not specified enough therapy for this. It was bizarre. One of my greatest heroes, Sarah Waters, was there. And she came up to me, and I didn't recognize her. And she said, oh, good luck. And I said, thank you. And she was like, I'm Sarah. And I was like, okay, Sarah. And she just went, Waters. And then I cried. there's Gillian Anderson and a random table, other famous, and it was just bizarre. I was just completely, like I said, I was a teacher 3 days ago. There's nothing that prepares you for this, but the way that I've come to see it is every good thing, take it as the surprise it is, and the rest.
What has it meant for writing the next book? Is there a pressure there on you now?
No. No, I'm terrified. I finished the first draft and I liked it. But I don't know if anyone else is going to like it.
Well, I'm sure we will. Can you please give a huge round of applause for Yael van der Weyden? Yael van der Weyden with me, Claire Nichols, at Sydney Writers' Festival. And since we had that conversation, Yael did find out what it's like to win a prize. She won the Women's Prize for Fiction for her wonderful novel, The Safe Keep. Now, this interview came straight from our archive. I have been
So lucky to speak to so many incredible authors over the years. If you have a favourite living novelist, I have probably spoken to them on The Book Show. You can find all our interviews in our back catalogue. Just make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen. The Book Show is made by me and by producer Sarah Lestrange. We work on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.